content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press and the Religion News Service. First of all, an article published by the Associated Press on April the 9th entitled, Pope at Easter, Pray for Ukrainian Russian People, Refugees, Vatican City. In an Easter message highlighting hope, Pope Francis on Sunday invoked prayers for both the Ukrainian and Russian people, praised nations that welcome refugees, and called on Israelis and Palestinians racked by the latest surge in deadly violence to forge a climate of trust. Francis, along with dozens of prelates and tens of thousands of faithful, celebrated Easter Mass in a flower-adorned St. Peter's Square, affirming the Christian belief that Jesus rose from the dead days after his crucifixion. The 86-year-old pontiff topped the celebration with a traditional speech about troubled places in the world, encouraging trust among individuals, peoples, and nations. Francis said Easter's joy illumines the darkness and gloom in which, all too often, our world finds itself enveloped. The Pope's Easter message is known by its Latin name, Urbi et Orbi, which means to the city and the world. Since Russia invaded neighboring Ukraine in February 2022, Francis has repeatedly called for the fighting to end and sought prayers for the martyred Ukrainian people. Ukrainian diplomats have complained that he hasn't come down hard enough in his statements on Russia, and particularly Russian President Vladimir Putin, as the Vatican tries to avoid alienating Moscow. Francis delivered his Easter speech while sitting in a chair on the central balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, facing the square. He urged the international community to work to end the war in Ukraine and all conflict and bloodshed in the world, beginning with Syria, which still awaits peace. Francis also prayed for those who lost loved ones in an earthquake that struck Syria and Turkey 2 months ago, claiming tens of thousands of lives. With a renewal in deadly violence affecting both Israelis and Palestinians in recent days, Francis called for a resumption of dialogue in a climate of trust and reciprocal respect between Israelis and Palestinians so that peace may reign in the Holy City and in the entire region, a reference to Jerusalem. But Francis also noted progress on some fronts. Let us rejoice at the concrete signs of hope that reach us from so many countries, beginning with those that offer assistance and welcome to all fleeing war and poverty, he said, without naming any particular nations. How to care for asylum seekers, migrants, and refugees, and whether to allow them entrance, is a raging political and social debate in much of Europe, as well as in the United States and elsewhere. Francis also prayed that national leaders ensure that no man or woman may encounter discrimination, and that there would be full respect for human rights and democracy. With migrants risking their lives in smugglers' unseaworthy boats in hopes of reaching Europe, the Pope lamented that Tunisia's people, particularly the young, struggle with social and economic hardship. In the last 2 weeks, dozens have died or were left missing after attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea from Tunisia. The Pope included Lebanon and two African countries he visited this year, South Sudan and Congo, among the nations in need of ending divisions and building reconciliation. By the end of the Pope's appearance, 100,000 people had flocked to the square in time for the pontiff's speech, according to the Vatican's crowd count. The pontiff was back in the public eye for the Mass 12 hours after a 2.25-hour-long Easter vigil ceremony in St. Peter's Basilica the night before. Francis was hospitalized March 29th through April the 1st for treatment of bronchitis. Still recovering, he skipped their traditional Good Friday procession at Rome's Colosseum due to unseasonably cold nighttime temperatures. Near the end of the more than two-hour-long Easter Sunday appearance, Francis seemed to run out of steam. His voice grew hoarse, and he interrupted his speech at one point to cough. He nonetheless made several laps through the square in the Popemobile after the mass, waving and smiling at cheering well-wishers. Another article from the Associated Press, this one published on the 2nd of April, entitled, "Ukrainian Court Puts an Orthodox Leader Under House Arrest," by Carl Ritter and Elena Bekatoros. Kyiv, Ukraine. A Kyiv court ordered a leading priest to be put under house arrest on April the 1st after Ukraine's top security agency said he was suspected of justifying Russian aggression, a criminal offense. It was the latest move in a bitter dispute over a famed Orthodox monastery. Metropolitan Pavel is the abbot of the Kyiv Pechersk Lavra Monastery, Ukraine's most revered Orthodox site. He has denied the charges and resisted the authorities' order to vacate the complex. In a court hearing earlier in the day, the Metropolitan said the claim by the Security Service of Ukraine, known as the SBU, that he condoned Russia's invasion was politically driven and that he had never been on the side of aggression. After the court's ruling, a monitoring bracelet was placed around his ankle, despite his objections that he has diabetes and should not wear it. The house arrest was to last 2 months. "I am accepting this," he said shortly before the bracelet was attached. "Christ was crucified on the cross, so why shouldn't I accept this?" Earlier in the week, he cursed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, threatening him with damnation. The monks in the monastery belong to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which has been accused of having links to Russia. The dispute surrounding the property, also known as the Monastery of the Caves, is part of a wider religious conflict that has unfolded in parallel with the war. The Ukrainian government has cracked down on the UOC over its historic ties to the Russian Orthodox Church, whose leader, Patriarch Kirill, has supported Russian President Vladimir Putin in the invasion of Ukraine. Many Orthodox communities in Ukraine have cut their ties with the UOC and transitioned to the rival Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which more than 4 years ago received recognition from the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople. The UOC has insisted that it is loyal to Ukraine and has denounced the Russian invasion. But Ukrainian security agencies say some in the church have maintained close ties with Moscow. The agencies have raided numerous holy sites of the church and then posted photos of rubles, Russian passports, and leaflets with messages from the Moscow Patriarch as proof that some church officials have been loyal to Russia. The government had ordered the monks to leave the compound by March 29. It claims they violated their lease by making alterations to the historic site and other technical infractions. The monks rejected the claim as a pretext. Dozens of UOC supporters gathered outside the monastery on April the 1st, singing hymns in the rain. A smaller group of protesters also turned up, accusing the other side of sympathizing with Moscow. "They wash the brains of people with Russian support, and they are very dangerous for Ukraine," said Sinia Kravchuk, a 38-year-old software developer from Kyiv. "They sing songs in support of Russia, and that's horrible here in the center of Kyiv." Third-year seminary student David, 21, disagreed. Dressed in a priest's robes and with a Ukrainian flag draped around his shoulders, he insisted the Lavra priests and residents were in no way pro-Russian. The state, he said, was trying to evict hundreds of people from Lavra without a court order. "Look at me. I'm in priest's clothes with a Ukrainian flag and a cross around my neck. Could you say that I'm pro-Russian?" said David, who declined to give his last name because of tensions surrounding the issue. The priests are currently singing a Ukrainian hymn, and they're being called pro-Russian. Can you believe it? Now, an article from Religion News Service that was published on the 23rd of March, written by Yonat Shimron, and entitled "Anti-Semitism Spiked in 2022, but Physical Assaults Were Few," Anti-Defamation League reports. A new audit of anti-Semitism in the U.S. shows a continued growth in the number of incidents reported in 2022. The Anti-Defamation League's newest report tabulated 3,697 anti-Semitic incidents last year in three categories: harassment, vandalism, and assault. According to the ADL, the rise in anti-Semitism represents a 36% increase from the 2,717 incidents tabulated in 2021, and the highest number on record since ADL began tracking anti-Semitic incidents in 1979. But the number of incidents categorized as assaults was relatively small, 111 in total, or about 3%. Four incidents included a deadly weapon. The report cites one death in 2022, but the victim in that case was not Jewish. Thomas Mexner, head of the Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona, was shot to death by a student on October 5. The professor was Catholic. Weeks after the shooting, it came to light that the student expressed anti-Semitic beliefs online. Half of the assaults, defined as attempts to inflict physical harm, were on Orthodox Jews whose dress distinguishes them as Jewish. The majority of these were in New York City. The most notable anti-Semitic attack in 2022 took place January 15, when a 44-year-old British citizen entered Congregation Beth Israel in Coleyville, Texas, and took four people, including the rabbi, hostage at gunpoint. After an 11-hour standoff, the hostages escaped unharmed, and the gunman was killed. The report also details 91 bomb threats called into or emailed to Jewish institutions or schools in 2022. But the majority of the incidents reported to ADL directly via its online form, email, or phone message constituted harassment. Of the total 3,697 incidents, 2,298 incidents were described as harassment, both in person and online. The report cites 852 incidents of white supremacist propaganda and 589 incidents, mostly of harassment, at Jewish institutions such as synagogues, community centers, and schools. The ADL audit's methodology has recently come under some criticism. Last May, ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, a view that many Jews reject. He also called out anti-Zionist groups, some of which are Jewish, as the photo inverse of the white nationalist right. We think it's really important for communities Jewish and beyond not to be painted with the same brush as people who are actively calling for violence, said Audrey Sasson, executive director of the New York-based Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. The 2022 audit says it did not include instances of legitimate anti-Israel political protest and expressions of opposition to Israeli policies. But the audit does include public statements of opposition to Zionism when it can be determined that they had a negative impact on one or more Jewish individuals or identifiable localized groups of Jews. And it did include cases of picketing of Jewish religious or cultural institutions for their purported or real support for Israel. David Shazner, a professor of the practice of public policy at Duke University, who teaches a class on combating hate in the digital age, said some of the incidents might be hard to impartially categorize. Some of the incidents rely on a subjective determination of whether opposition to Israel and Zionism bleeds into anti-Semitism, Shasner said. But it is also the case that some anti-Zionist protests do rely on anti-Semitic tropes or call for the destruction of the Jewish state or harm to people living in Israel. The anti-Semitic audit comes 1 week after a Pew Research study found that far more Americans express favorable than unfavorable views of Jews. In fact, the study found Jews rated higher in American estimations than any other religious group. While 81% of Jews rated their own group favorably, Christians across various subgroups also rated Jews much more favorably than unfavorably. Among evangelicals, 45% rated Jews favorably compared with 6% who have an unfavorable view toward Jews. Jews were also the only religious group who received a positive rating from atheists, the study found. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on March 27, written by Yonat Shimron, and entitled, Purple Church Pastors Mull Leadership Strategies in Polarizing Times. Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Each Wednesday evening, a group of congregants from the First Baptist Church of Mount Olive, located about 65 miles southeast of Raleigh, gathers for a Bible study called Tackling Tough Topics Together. The 10 to 20 regulars have discussed race, human sexuality, and mental illness. Those kinds of conversations are rare and becoming rarer at churches like First Baptist, which is affiliated with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, a network of congregations that offers a moderate alternative to the Southern Baptist Convention. CBF-affiliating churches generally allow for women's ordination and view the Bible as authoritative, but not literal. They are distinguished these days by the diversity of their congregations, mostly white, but tending to be split nearly equally between Republican-leaning and Democratic-leaning voters. They are, as the CBF of North Carolina likes to call themselves, neither red nor blue churches, but purple. In an era of increasing polarization, when a deeply acrimonious partisan divide has permeated nearly all aspects of American life, including church, that's a tough spot to be in. A recent survey of 467 local pastors by two University of North Carolina political scientists found that of seven Christian groups surveyed in the state, cooperative Baptist churches were the most evenly politically divided, ahead of Methodists, while at the other end, Pentecostals and Southern Baptists were the least divided. That makes political discussions in the country's 1,800 or so CBF-affiliating churches particularly fraught, because pastors risk alienating half the church's members. It's constraining the kind of debates on moral issues that pastors in purple churches feel comfortable addressing, said Lisbeth Hoag, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who authored the study along with Gary Marks and Stephanie N. Shady. For First Baptist pastor Dennis Atwood, who attended the Leadership Forum for CBF Pastors in Winston-Salem in March, the effort to reach members about the moral issues of the day is worth the effort. We're pushed into dualistic thinking where we have to have either or, he said. My approach is to model a big tent approach. We can have unity without uniformity. Historian Kristen Cobes-Dumez, whose best-selling book, Jesus and John Wayne, traces the rise of militant masculinity in evangelical churches, spoke at the retreat about the difficulty of leading an evangelical congregation in polarizing times. Most white evangelicals were not marching with neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, nor were most evangelicals storming the Capitol on January 6, Dumas told some 200 church leaders at the Leadership Forum, sponsored by CBF of North Carolina, on March the 23rd. But it's also true that underlying affinities make it difficult for mainstream moderate evangelicals to unequivocally condemn these acts. The coronavirus pandemic exacerbated polarization as masking and meeting in person became flashpoints. Several CBF pastors said they lost members who either thought the church was too cautious to reopen or not cautious enough. Many CBF pastors at the Leadership Forum said they struggle with preaching about political issues. Some said their solution is to stick as closely as possible to the biblical text and rely on the lectionary or appointed scripture readings to guide what they say on Sunday mornings, only speaking to political or cultural issues if there's a direct analogy in the text. That strategy has helped Lee Kniep, pastor of Providence Baptist Church in Charlotte, which affiliates with the CBF. Church members can criticize his interpretation of a scripture passage, but, he said, will not offer opinion. People tend to be much more open to hearing something uncomfortable when it's coming from the Bible, Kniep said. The forum offered these often besieged pastors workshops with titles such as Self-Care in an Anxious Age and Effective Leadership in a Time of Polarization. At one workshop, writer, theologian, and former pastor F. Timothy Moore challenged pastors to think of the Bible as a text that lends itself to numerous interpretations. He pointed out that the Bible has multiple accounts of key stories, including the creation story, the Ten Commandments, and Jesus' birth. Most pastors conflate the different versions of these stories or try to smooth out the contradictions. In a polarized world, what would happen if we considered teaching the Bible as a conversation or a dialogue with multiple ideas? Moore asked a group of pastors. Balancing those interpretations and mustering the courage to speak out on moral issues of the day is no easy task. Yet, as Dumas told the church leaders at the conference, the stakes are high. The state of democracy and possibly our communal good may come down to the folks in the middle, she said. If you feel like you're up against a lot, you are. Our next article, published by the Religion News Service on March the 31st, was written by Jack Jenkins and entitled, Catholic Nun's Letter Declares Trans People Beloved and Cherished by God. Washington. A coalition led by Catholic nuns, representing thousands of women religious and associates at partner groups, released a public letter on March 31, voicing support for transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals, declaring they are beloved and cherished by God, and implicitly rebuking recent statements from the U.S. Catholic hierarchy. As members of the body of Christ, we cannot be whole without the full inclusion of transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals, the letter reads. It goes on to argue that we will remain oppressors until we, as vowed Catholic religious, acknowledge the existence of LGBTQ people in their own congregations. We seek to cultivate a faith community where all, especially our transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive siblings, experience a deep belonging. The letter also states transgender people are experiencing harm and erasure in various ways, listing daily discrimination, a groundswell of state legislation aimed at LGBTQ rights, and harmful rhetoric from some Christian institutions and their leaders, including the Catholic Church. Prepared by representatives from various communities, including the U.S. Federation of the Sisters of St. Joseph, Sisters of Providence of St. Mary of the Woods, Indiana, and Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth JPIC office. The letter list orders of nuns and other organizations representing more than 6,000 vowed religious across 18 states. The letter also lists ways to take action, such as supporting New Ways Ministry, a Catholic LGBTQ outreach group, or signing a statement highlighting a Catholic commitment to trans affirmation from Dignity USA. The nuns' effort comes in the wake of a doctrinal statement published earlier this month by a committee of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which discouraged Catholic healthcare groups from performing various gender-affirming medical procedures, arguing that doing so does not respect the intrinsic unity of body and soul. Sister Barbara Batista, the Congregation Justice Promoter for the Sisters of Providence, St. Mary of the Woods, noted the letter was already in the works before the bishops unveiled their doctrinal statement. Batista said she and other crafters of the letter were initially responding to the wave of bills being considered in state legislatures that target transgender rights. When the bishop's statement became public, Batista said it jump-started their efforts. There's a sense of urgency in me to say that there are many, many faithful Catholics who know a different way, said Batista, who has publicly advocated for other causes in the past. We need to find opportunities to speak up and to say, we are with you, we support you. Batista noted that many of the bills working their way through state legislatures revolve around the health care needs of trans people, an issue that hits home for her as a licensed physician's assistant in Indiana. She described her work as participating in the healing ministry of Jesus, rooted, she said, in a sacred trust between patients and providers. We have run out of time for this week's Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.